You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
You're not going to have fun unless we get a dime on this bitch.
Happy holidays, everyone. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Every week, we give you talk that goes below the surface and outside the lines with some of the most important figures in hip-hop. I'm your host, Rap Genius Editor-in-Chief, same old Sean. This week, we talk to Reggie Osei, better known as Combat Jack. Reggie is a blogger and the host of the Combat Jack Show on PNC Radio, a show that featured a notable appearance by Rap Genius just a few weeks ago. Before all that, though, Reggie was a high-powered music attorney with his hands in basically every hot song of the 90s. We met up with him at our Rap Genius office in Brooklyn.
Now we got to be theatrical.
Yeah, I know. Welcome to Outside the Lines with same old Sean.
Thanks for having me.
You're with Reggie Osei.
Yes, sir.
A.K.A. Combat Jack.
That's right.
Yeah. So, for our, you know, listeners, viewers who might not know a ton about your history, can you give us kind of a brief rundown of you know, your vast
Brooklyn
career?
Guy, Cornell, Georgetown Law, Def Jam, attorney, ran my own practice with Ed Woods from, VH1 show, the MTV, well, anyway, Ed Woods is my former partner. Ran a very popular, very hot law firm during the 90s. We represented Jay-Z and Rockefeller. We did a lot of work with Diddy. Any big song that came out in the 90s, we had our hands on it, from Michael Jackson to DMX. Got burned out with the industry in 04, discovered blogs, was greatly influenced and actually kind of mentored by your friend, Byron Crawford, who actually got me to a certain level of notoriety because I felt comfortable writing as Combat Jack and, you know, shared some of my intimate stories with the industry, then connected with your other friend, Dallas Penn, and then decided, I think it was in 2008, 2009, to start my own blog, the Daily Math. Once again, got, you know, great notoriety, kind of veered off into internet radio, just launched the Combat Jack Show 2 years ago, and here I am.
Great. Well,
That's it.
All right, you can go. Thanks for stopping. I actually wanted to talk about the Combat Jack Show itself.
Right. Okay.
It's a really unique thing. So it's this interesting hybrid, right? You have this side of it that's an interview show, you know, similar to like Von Epstein thing or similar to this or whatever. And then on the other hand, it's a more sort of traditional, you know, radio show with the crew, and everyone has their personality, and the show's about the banter between them. How do you keep those elements in balance and not have one side overshadow the other?
I really, like, in terms of influence, I really have to credit the Stern Show, Howard Stern. I mean, because everything that we do on our show is exactly what Stern does. It's the insanity, it's the banter, it's, you know, you get a little personal with the characters, you get to know who the characters are, particularly the flaws, because I think that's what attracts the fans. And then you have the interviews. And as crazy as Howard Stern's reputation is for all the crazy shit that he's done, like, he gives some of the best interviews. And I think particularly now where some people may feel that he's washed up, he gives great in-depth interviews, particularly with characters or personalities that he may or may not know, like, or personalities that I may or may not know. But in his interviews, he always brings about, everyone has a story to tell, and he brings out the story, and you become more interested in that person, regardless if you had no interest in that individual or hated that individual. You kind of feel like there's more humanity to that person right now. So I credit everything that I do on the show really to being a huge fan of The Surgeon. What we're doing is not that different. It's been done before. I think what people are tripping on is, I guess, in this urban setting, if you want to consider us quote-unquote black internet radio, you haven't really necessarily seen that. And so I guess that's what makes what we're doing so novel and so new. But I'm definitely jacking the Stern model.
Yeah. And how'd you assemble, you have such a diverse crew
right.
on there. How'd you assemble the crew? And why have that many people on what's essentially like an interview-based show?
You know, it was very organic. Initially, Dallas was approached to do an internet radio show. And Dallas asked if I would be interested. I was interested, and then that thing fell apart. A year later, I decided that I wanted to do internet radio. I asked Dallas to be involved. Dallas was a bit cautious and said, you know what, I'll do it, but you be the front guy. So it was really supposed to be just Dallas and I. And as we progressed, DJ Ben Hameen called me one day and was like, would you mind if I DJ for your show? Because before then, I would just have to every week prepare what the playlist would be. Matt Raz started hanging around and got some mic time. Premium Pete came by one day and then eventually started. People come to, you've been to the show. People come to the show. For some reason, it's this event that some people feel that they have to be at on a weekly basis. And some of the people that get there, I guess when they get an opportunity to get the mic, and if there's some type of resonance with the audience, they become fixtures. So it's this whole thing was not planned out. It's been a very organic process, and I think that's the magic of what we do. It is very organic. I mean, now, you know, we have 7 members, and in traditional radio, that can't work. So there has to be some adjustments. But once again, looking at the Stern Show, the Stern Show has a universe of characters that always get airtime, and they are, they're recurring. You know, they have recurring roles. Some people are permanent fixtures, and we're working it out. But it's been a totally organic process. The most interesting member that joined our cast was Just Blaze.
I was going to ask about him because obviously people know his music,
right.
And maybe remember his XXL column,
right.
And they're like, oh, that's the producer who likes video games, but don't know much about him as a personality. And so it's really interesting to hear him, talk and on your show.
Once again, very very organic incident. I interviewed Just Blaze for, I guess, a piece we did at The Source while I was briefly at The Source. From there, I used that contact to bring him to interview him for the show. So Just came to the show, and we interviewed him, and he had such a great time. But I think the magic of the show is, for the most part, everyone has a great time. So Just had a great time, and, Just is kind of, like, nerdy like us, and he's kind of, like, down to earth. So we created this rapport online with Twitter, and then he had a birthday party that same year. Dallas and I attended it. My family came. And then we really got kind of a little bit closer than I usually do with, I guess, my industry colleagues. And it got really weird because it was just like I tweet something and he'd respond, and he'd tweet something and I would respond, and Dallas would respond. So we had this kind of rapport going on Twitter. And one day I was like, dude, like, it seems like you should be on the show. And he was like, it's funny because I just had a dream that I was on the show. And I was like, fuck, won't you come on the show? And next thing I know, Just Blaze is a member of the show. So it was that simple. It wasn't me having this nefarious plan to get like this, big name.
Red famous super producer.
It happened. And I think that's also what works. It happened and just fits so seamlessly. And yeah, we kind of are still in awe at, his fame and his... the brightness of his star, but in terms of what he brings to the table, it's seamless.
Yeah.
Excellent.
And I would assume if you see someone every week that tends to, at least get placed in the background a little bit.
And we're still getting to know each other because I think he's only been on the show for about 7-8 months, but we're still getting to know each other, and we've had the opportunity to travel with each other and do shows out of state. So it's an ongoing process. It's a building relationship. I just feel very fortunate that we have all of these people that see something in this. Because I still, I know what I'm modeling it after. I'm still amazed at times when, I'm somewhere and I overhear a conversation about someone talking about the Combat Jack show or or running into someone who I feel is, you know, of such high stature, and they're like, dude, I really enjoyed that episode. So I'm still kind of pinching myself that this thing is happening.
Yeah, definitely. Going back to something you said a little bit earlier, you talked about how when you were a lawyer, when you're really up in the industry, you could never reveal your weaknesses.
Right.
Right.
Well, not necessarily as a lawyer thing, but the industry.
It's an industry, yeah.
It's all Hollywood. It's all make-believe.
Yeah. But now as a blogger and as a radio host, you've really found a strength in your weaknesses.
Right.
You're talking about how the audience of your show relates to the weaknesses and personality
right.
quirks of your cast members. What sort of weaknesses personally do you find yourself able to talk about now that you couldn't back when you were sort of with Diddy?
Well, I think you just said it right there. In the industry, you always have to be stunting.
Yeah.
You know, you always have to be, your swag always has to be on.
Yeah.
Right now, I have no swag. Right now, when I go home, I'm just dad. You know, I'm fixing leaks, I'm changing diapers, I'm like missing out on bills, you know what I'm saying? This shit is not pretty right now.
Yeah.
And I think in this internet age, while some people might have that old school mentality of stunting and flossing, it's like, and I'm an older person, I've been through that. And it's like, after a certain point, you can only hear but so much of what people have and what people are driving and how many models and how many drugs. I mean, all of that shit, we've all heard that narrative. But particularly in hip-hop, how many people are brave enough to talk about where they're not excelling at? You know, I'm overweight right now. You know what I'm saying? I get bitched out. You know, I miss payments. Like, you know what I'm saying? Life is harder now than it was before. I've got responsibilities. I've got my kids. You know, sometimes they disrespect me. But it's this story that is real. It's real. And I think, you know, particularly in our community, in the entertainment industry, we need to hear that because there's strength in your mortality. There's strength in your humanity. I'm tired of hearing about these superhero type beings, and I think the general audience is as well. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's what made Eminem great, and as great as Jay-Z is as an MC, even though he's probably the biggest stunter, what really attracted a huge, at least his initial audience to him, is when he talked about his frailties, about selling mom's crack to his mom, or shooting his brother, all of these missteps that he took. You kind of got a sense of who he was amidst all of this, you know, super rap MC god.
Yeah, definitely. A couple of years ago, you wrote something that really caught my attention about how bloggers are the new rappers.
Yes.
Yeah. It seems like, if anything, that's only become kind of more true over the years.
Yes.
I was hoping you can go into that a little bit. What exactly you meant by that? What similarities you see? You know, what places you see being filled?
You know, particularly, I guess, during the golden era of rap blogs, which was like 2005, you had all of these colorful names, colorful blogs coming out. You know, the Nah Rights and the Two Dope Boys and the Dallas Pens. And, of course, I think the godfather of it all is Brian Crawford. And, you know, every day you would log on and these blogs would be stages as to what these cats would come up with next. So I don't know about what their mindset was, but me entering into this medium, I always looked at every day as being another performance. Like, what am I going to come up with? How am I going to strategically deliver my content? How am I going to exit the stage with grace? So I handle it as if I were a rapper. And I viewed my peers as colleagues as well as possible competitors. And, you know, the whole blog beef thing to me is no different than any rap beef thing. And, you know, I always saw in the best rap beefs, there was beauty out of it. There was drama. There was, you know, danger. There was excitement. There was art. And my thing is, like, I see the same thing. I saw the same thing with regard to the blog world. Here are all these blog superstars who, you know, perform on a daily basis and have these beefs. So how artful are they going to be in their delivery? You know, how theatrical are they going to be? How are they going to draw this out? I think, once again, the godfather of this whole thing, Byron Crawford, has been able to maintain kind of like this, in a sense, rock star kind of aura in what he does on a daily basis. I think that the blogosphere has changed dramatically in a very short period of time, but in 05, 06, 07, there definitely was kind of like that rock star, rap star type of quality to these individual bloggers that were out there.
Yeah. And one of your, I think unless I'm misreading stuff you wrote, your initial fascination with blogs came about because there were people who were by and large outside the music industry. What do you think about now when it seems like blogs are very quickly becoming sort of swallowed by the industry?
I guess there was a lot of what attracted me to the medium was the honesty. And regardless if, you know, it was misguided or misinformed or some of it just, you know, coming from a bad place, it was very honest. I think what's happened right now is you have more, it's become this content aggregation game. I'm not driven to read blogs anymore. You know, I still read Byron Crawford, I still read the Dallas Pens, but people are not writing as much anymore. People aren't reading as much anymore. People are looking for the quick hits. What's new, what's out, what's popping right now. So the game has definitely changed. What was the initial question?
About blogs sort of getting stuck in the industry as a whole.
I think they've become kind of like this this extension of like the advertising arm of the labels or the artists or whatever. So it's become kind of like the same thing. You go on, and this is no shot, you know, because I do still go to some of these blogs to see what's new, but I go to these blogs now to see what's new, not what someone's thinking, what story this person has, what angle this person has come up with. I just come to see what's new. It's kind of like opening up the newspaper right now, as opposed to being entertained. I'm not entertained, I'm not amused, now I'm just informed.
We were talking about, beef a second ago, and you were around one of the largest and saddest of all rap beefs in the East Coast, West Coast, when you were kind of in the center of that, being close to the Bad Boy camp. You were pretty close to them when Biggie was murdered, and when I was reading stuff you wrote about it, you said his death made everyone numb, everyone in that camp.
Yeah.
How were the core people in that group, including yourself, like, even after the numbness wore off and the initial shock, permanently changed by what happened to Big?
You know, words are really powerful. And up until, you know, Tupac's passing, and up until Biggie's passing, it was just still words. You know, rappers throwing beef at each other and, you know, the threats and the whole nine. But when these words manifested into reality, at least for me, it was like, okay, there are now actual ramifications to what you put out there. The world has become, the industry stopped being a fairy tale, and it was like, okay, now this is, people are, and we really got to see the underside, the ugly side of what the industry was. I mean, gangsters have always been attracted to the industry, but now you really saw.
Well, predating.
Of course, of course, gangsters have always been from day one, but now you really saw where, particularly with the emergence of Death Row and Suge Knight, who really made, when he came into the industry, he made it a point to announce that the game was going to change. And years later, with the untimely deaths of these legends, it's like, oh, shit has really changed. So now, is it fun anymore? Is it like this innocent sense of fun? Is it this innocent sense of, like, your hobby becoming your career? Or is it now a career with all of these dangerous possibilities? And is it where it just became so heavy. Like, it was a major, massive shift. When Biggie died, I remember specifically, Puff didn't know if he wanted to continue. We didn't know if he wanted to continue. So many people were so just disillusioned with the because it was like, why did these two individuals, great individuals, of course, their beef was understandable, but why did they have to lose their lives? Like, if the stakes are now this high, why are we even involved in this shit?
Yeah, you said one time that if, you know, you could have seen what would have happened, you thought maybe people would have chosen not to make Hit Him Up as a song in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, people, I mean, at the end of the day, we have that animalistic desire for the red meat, for the, you know, for the blood and for the guts. But like I said, up until that, it was still fun. It was still entertainment. But, you know, as these records started to ratchet up and the tensions and whatever, the entanglement, and there's so much backstory behind this shit. There's so much backstory. There's so much, like, politics that are involved in these two guys' deaths. But I don't think, if I had a fortune, if I had a crystal ball, there was no way I would have enjoyed these songs, knowing that these two individuals would have lost their life. There's no possible way. And even now when you hear beef, I mean, there's something still exciting about rap beef. I mean, it's so fucking, you know, it's awesome. It's an integral part of the culture. But now it's like, oh my God, how far is this thing going to escalate? Can we keep this on wax? Right. Can we keep this on blogs?
Right. And prior to 95, 96,
no, nah. I mean, you know, you had incidents where somebody would get punched in the eye, the whole Rex in Effect and Tribe Called. You had physical, you know, things did bleed out of the studio. But I think, you know, at the time that was accepted. Like, somebody might catch a punch in the eye or whatever. But once the guns came out, man, it was like, yo, we got to be a little bit more. You know, I did a piece on my show a couple of months ago about Papoose, and then the threats started getting real.
Wow. Yeah, I heard your monologue about him.
The threats started getting real, and I was like, you know what? It's not worth it. Like, I'm not afraid or anything, but I have a family, and I have team members, and it's like I would hate for something to escalate because I was being very honest about what I felt about an artist.
Sure. And unfortunately, it's often the tangential guys, right, yeah, who feel like they have to
prove something. My wife said something to me really interesting. She's like, you're coming from a place where, you know, you're kind of like viewed as this intellectual and this critic and this quote-unquote tastemaker, but you don't know where these guys are coming from. You don't. Some of these guys, and I know it, some of these guys are just coming out of jail, and whomever, you know, might be the topic or the subject of ridicule, that might be the person that's helping them pay their bills. So at this point, if this person is, if there's any threat to this person's career tanking, you know, it takes nothing for somebody to run up on you and eliminate that threat. I mean, that's the reality of the world that we live in right now. We're all very, and I'm proud, I'm very happy that I'm very accessible, but that's, you know, it's a tightrope.
Yeah. I wanted to move back in your career a little bit to the very beginnings of your lawyering days. You worked on a record that I love and I think is a real unappreciated gem, and I was hoping you could talk a little bit about it and how it led to your career lawyering as sort of the hip-hop lawyer guy, and that's the Two Kings and the Cypher.
It's so funny. Two Kings and the Cypher. I owe a lot, so much to Angeletti.
For our listeners who might not know, that's Derek Angeletti, D. Dot the Mad Rapper, his sort of very first record with Ron Lawrence,
Amon Ra, who became, both of them became someone like somewhat of like the glue that, or like the initial building blocks that Puffy utilized to build his Hitman production empire. I mean, they were literally the first rap group that I ever represented. And the attorney that I was working with at the time, Louise West, she was a legend, I guess, in the R&B world. She was managing, you know, R&B singer Glenn Jones, and had done a lot of stuff with Midnight Star. And like, she was well known in the end, but she had the foresight to realize that the industry was changing, and she had to expand her firm to incorporate hip hop. And I was like one of the first guys coming out of law school at that time that was 100% hip hop and understood hip hop and was also very qualified to, you know, as an attorney to represent hip hop artists. So Two Kings and the Cypher, man, they were our first. They were my first. That was my rap legal cherry. And, you know, it was a small record, but it resonated. You know, D-Dot and Amon Ra were from Howard University. So it definitely resonated, I guess, you know, to a certain extent. I mean, yeah, they were my first rap group. So that kind of, and then when they graduated to, like, the School of Puffy, it was just like dominoes being strategically aligned and opening up further doors for us, because as artists they brought us notoriety, but as producers, that, you know, that's when the floodgates opened up.
Yeah. What was it like being around Bad Boy at its sort of commercial height?
It was magic. It was nothing but magic, because you'd see these people, and I knew Puffy for years before the industry.
Did you know him in his DC days?
I didn't know him in his DC days. I knew him in his early New York industry days, and Puffy was all over the place. Like, I could not predict that Puffy would be where he is today, but I knew that Puffy was going to be somewhere. And Puffy was just everywhere that was hot in New York, and New York was a hot place. So if you were everywhere and it was hot, you had to be super hot. So before the fame and the glory and the videos and the multi-million dollars and the whole nine, Puffy was the it guy. in New York. He had the best parties. He had his own little scene. And watching him go from, like, the Uptown days, because Uptown was so huge in New York at the time, going from Uptown and just, like, the Mary J. phenomenon. Like, when Mary J. Blige dropped, like, I was just thinking the other day, when What's the 411 dropped, it was a magical time in our lives. It was a magical time. And here's this guy that's in the middle of all that. When Jodeci dropped, it was a magical time. So when Bad Boy formed, it was like, oh, so it's really showtime, because this is now the hip-hop aspect. Biggie was undeniable. Even before Biggie, I remember the first time I heard Craig Mack's song, Flavor in the Air. It was so hypnotic. It was like so fucking hypnotic. And I remember the first time being in the tunnel, not the tunnel, Palladium. First time being in the Palladium. And Puffy was there with some of his team members, and I think it was Flex dropped Flavor in Your Ear in the Palladium, and you knew that it was ground zero. It was ground zero for what was to happen next. So it was like, it was just a magical time. Everything was clicking, and Puffy was in the center of it. Yeah. Like, everybody wanted to be Puffy or wanted to have a piece of Puffy or wanted to be part of that movement, because we didn't know where it was going, but we knew it was leading. Yeah. At least the New York scene at the time.
Yeah. Another rap icon you've worked with a lot is Jay-Z.
Jay-Z,
Dame Dash. Something that surprised me about what you said about Jay, you've talked a lot about your, you know, relationship with him at the start of his career and the, you know, 10 years he put in before he got on and all this stuff. It really surprised me to hear you mention him, or hear you mention him as your most fashionable client.
From the start, I mean, you know, you.
What would he dress like, circa like 94?
I mean, Jay always, like, if everyone at the time was rocking Hilfiger, everybody was rocking Hilfiger. He'd be rocking Dada, which was like an unknown label. I mean, an unknown brand, but it was still different. Like, he went out of his way from the gate to be different, and you know, at the time, what was fashionable in New York, a lot of people rocked silver and gold. Silver was very fashionable at the time. I had a lot of dope silver pieces. And the first time I met Jay-Z, and I think he's referring to me in that song. First time I met Jay-Z, he was in my office. Clark Kent brought him by. And he had this amazing necklace and pendant. And I automatically thought it was silver, but it, just the way it gleamed, it was just so fucking different.
So I was like, thought it was silver.
Yeah, so I was like, Jay, yo, that's some dope shit you got there. Is that silver? And in his arrogant, cocky way, he just scoffed. He didn't fucking answer me. He was just like, ah, silver, huh? Like this shit was cute. And it wasn't until, you know, this is way before the platinum.
Before the record,
I didn't know what the fuck platinum was. Right. Nobody knew what platinum was.
Yeah.
You know, so Jay was, like, from day one, he was rocking platinum.
Yeah.
From day one, you know, if cats were rocking the, you know, whatever cars cats were rocking, he was rocking the Lexuses. He made it a point to have something that no one else. And I think that was a Brooklyn thing. Like, I kind of had that, like, cats were rocking Polo, I was rocking Stussy. Like, you always wanted to have some leg up on what everybody else had. And Jay actually was one of the best that did it, because he always stood out. Like, he would rock a pair of Adidas, and the next thing I know, me and my law partner would go and try to find those sneakers. Because he rocked it well.
Amazing. One other thing about your lawyering days that was crazy, I was reading, I think it was something you wrote about the Nice and Smooth record, and the sample clearance consisted of you literally sitting down with the album and having to figure out the samples yourself.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the creative process, and I think that still exists today, you know, producers and these beatsmiths are in their own world. And you can't blame their job really is to deliver the product, to come up with something new. It's a sense of like musical alchemy. So, you know, when it comes to our stage, the legal stage, and you're like, what samples? Like, they're like, fuck, I don't know. But to get these records cleared, like, you never wanted to work on an album and put it out and have the album shelved because of some legal claims. And that's happened to me. And
I was going to ask if you ever missed something big.
The biggest thing that I didn't miss, the biggest thing that I fucked up on was, what was the name of the group? It was an R&B group. You've Got to Live and Learn. It was something Joe. I forgot the name of the group. But there was a small sample, a very small James Brown sample. And the attorney that I was working for at the time was like, just clear that sample. I was like, this shit is so small. Joe, I forgot the name of I want to look him up.
Yeah.
During this interview, I want to look up the name of the group. But this sample, like, this record started to get bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And I remember just one night coming home from Nell's and being in the cab and listening to that song, Live and Learn, on the radio. And I was like, I fucked up. And lo and behold, James Brown people came knocking. And what would have been a simple fee became a huge percentage of that record. And at the end of the day, everybody looked at me, and that's when I really understood firsthand.
Joe Public.
Yeah. Joe Public. That's when I realized the importance of clearing every aspect of a record. So now we're working on Nice and Smooth's album, and they had all these obscure samples, and the shit was so fucking tedious to try and find and listen to records. And we didn't have the internet then. So we had, you know, it was just a tedious process. And
is that still standard practice for still, the attorneys got, to you figure still, it out?
Well, I don't think, it's not the attorney's job, but I think, you know, particularly in these mom and shop law firms that we ran, you have kind of like this intimacy with your clients. So there's this closeness where, you know, whereas the Park Avenue firm wouldn't tolerate that shit. It's like, you know, I'll look out for you, because it's kind of like one hand washing the other. That's the type of, that's the uniqueness you get in those relationships.
Yeah. Amazing. So you briefly, I don't know how much you can talk about this, but I know you briefly worked at MTV.
Yes.
And
hated it.
The only credits I saw for your time there and the research I did were some like heavy metal shows.
Yeah. I worked on Headbangers Ball.
What was that like, working at something so far, you know, outside the lane?
It really wasn't. I mean, my job there was to take any on-air brand, like Laguna Beach was huge at the time. Look at any on-air brand, see if there was any type of ancillary possibilities with regard to soundtracks, DVDs, CDs, and the whole nine. So one of the gigs that I was assigned to was Headbangers Ball. I was like, you know, heavy metal is still such a small, I mean, it's a niche community. People live and die by that music. Headbangers Ball, let's take some of the best music and put out a CD.
Incredible. You briefly and kind of obliquely mentioned on your blog problems that you had at MTV and some of the very troubling racial dynamics.
You know,
air,
I mean,
there.
It's funny, man. Like, you know, I can't specifically talk about my situation at MTV, but MTV, to the outside world, you would imagine, you know, they, like most corporations that are existing today, they claim this whole, you know, feel-good philosophy of, like, inclusion and diversity. But when you get inside and you see who's making decisions and who has been making decisions from day one, you know, you see that that's not the case. And I know so many people that have contributed so much to at least, you know, the hip-hop presence at MTV. And at a certain point when the show starts to pop and Eminem is not on the top of the list, then there are ramifications for these people who haven't placed Eminem as the best MC of the world, in the world. You know, it's that mentality that exists in MTV. Like, every 5 years, there are so many credible executives of color that have brought so much to the table. And once that television brand pops, it's like, well, you're no longer needed. So the turnover rate at MTV, particularly with people of color, is so great, so vast. And it's not just fuck-ups. I'm not talking about fucks. I'm talking about people that have contributed to MTV. Like someone like a Shaheem Reed, who's contributed to MTV. Why is he not there anymore? Someone like Ramon Dukes. I just found out that he left them. Why is he not there? Why is he not, you know, executive vice president or vice president of a certain department? There's something wrong with that institute. There's something wrong about that.
Yeah. So getting back to you a little more, sort of early days, without getting too specific, you're of an age where you remember music before hip-hop.
Yes.
And what perspective do you think that gives you, as opposed to kids now who grow up, you know, only knowing rap?
I don't know. I mean, what perspective? I mean, once again, it's, and we were talking about this earlier before we started taping, there was a magic when you could listen to a Stevie Wonder and a Fleetwood Mac and a David Bowie and a Parliament Funkadelic on the same radio station. You know, you were being fed this world of music. And in our young minds, there was no difference between the Stevie Wonders and the Fleetwood Macs. It was just good music. It was good harmony and rhythm. It was just good music. So you got to appreciate a lot more. You got to appreciate the songwriting. You got to appreciate, you know, just the musicianship that these people were bringing to the table. What we hear right now, I can't stand listening to the radio. Like, I can't stand this. I drive a lot in the morning. I drive my kids to school. I drive my wife around. And I'm constantly turning the music, the radio off, because it's the same format. It's become so narrow. So even when my son wants to play me new music, like, I feel, and, you know, I'm old. I don't want to be, like, the old guy, like, criticizing everything that's new. But a lot of the new shit that he brings me sounds the same. And it's like, I don't want to just listen to the same sounding shit, you know? So I think these kids are being robbed of, like, what the possibilities are, like, how broad the universe of music is.
Yeah, it seems like New York radio in that era was just such an incredible conduit. I was talking to Trisha Rose, the author, about that, and she grew up in New York right around the same time. And just, she said, like, the entire sort of, you know, all types of diasporic music were there. From,
I mean,
you know, Island to, you know.
I mean, Frankie Crocker was, you know, on WBLS was such a pioneer, because, you know, he'd play the McFadden and Whiteheads, but then he'd play, you know, Here in My Car. What was that group? He'd play, like, you know, some electro, new wave shit. Like, he'd play punk. He'd play, I mean, I remember, like, the clubs I would go to, like, listening to Mick Jagger, Lucky in Love. Like, it wasn't just MMG. It wasn't just Young Money.
Yeah.
It wasn't just Kanye. And no shots to them, because they're at the top of their game right now. But it was this cultural stew. And it was so enriching, if you were looking to be enriched. Because there were a lot of New Yorkers back then that were still very... I mean, people are going to be closed-minded. But for someone that's looking at... Someone that's young and looking at the world as this oyster and wanting to ingest all of these influences, it was the right time. I think you have to... I mean, the great thing about it now is you have the internet. You can search if you are so inclined to go beyond your boundaries. But things are just so ghettoized across the board.
Definitely. And can you talk a bit related to that about the downtown 80s scene? I know you used to spend a lot of time at the garage.
Shit was beautiful. Shit was beautiful. Like, it was beautiful. Like it was like it was kind of like an extension of hip hop. Like, Keith Haring kind of was like an extension of hip hop, even though he wasn't hip hop per se. He was involved in hip hop. Like, he, you know, it would rap. There were dancers around him. There were DJs around. It was just this. It was this cultural stew. So, for someone growing up in Brooklyn, and a lot of cats on my block were like, yo, why are you fucking hanging out in the Village? You know, these are the guys that were closed-minded. But in the Village, it was like this mix. You could just go grab a bag of weed, sit in a Washington Square Park, and just be. It was better than any movie you could spend your money on. It was better than any television show, any book you could read, because it was just all walks of life. And shit that you didn't even expect would just open up in front of your eyes. So it was this, you can mix and match and borrow from every fucking culture that existed at the time.
Which is, as hip-hop is...
But you can't even say it was hip-hop. It was New York.
Yeah.
It was New York. I mean, even 42nd Street, as seedy as it was, it was Technicolor. It was just anything you... I mean, from Kung Fu to, like, the Three Cod Money scams to, like, the dances to even, like, the presence of prostitution. It was just so much going on.
Yeah. It's crazy.
It was like the options were, like, the it was like a, you know what it was? It was kind of like it was a literal internet where everything was at your disposition and you could search and you could find it.
Yeah. So funny. You mentioned the Three Cod Money thing. Right. I have a friend who, you know, an Italian guy in Bay Ridge who actually ended up a rapper. But, you know, got his spending money in high school doing three card money.
Yeah. I mean, it was a circus. New York was a circus. And I don't know what was going on, you know, financially and politically, because I was just a kid at the time. Yeah. But it was just so much. If I wanted to just spend a whole day watching Kung Fu movies, I can do that.
Yeah. And as far as that scene, the kind of downtown, you know, expansive scene,
going back
to that. What do you think... put an end to that? Was it just the AIDS epidemic?
I think it was more so like the crackdown, the Giuliani epidemic, because with those scenes, it was, you know, a lot of drugs. It was a lot of drugs going on at the time. from marijuana to, like, you know, heavier drugs, cocaine, mescaline, a whole lot of drugs, hallucinogenics, the whole nine. The drinking laws changed in New York, and I mean, I guess the city really wasn't benefiting financially from the scene, at least directly. I mean, from the comedians performing in Washington Square Park, all these performers having, like, this free stage. Like, New York got corporatized. And she cracked down on a lot of shit, man. And slowly but surely sucked out the spontaneity of, like, these scenes. And although New York has been a moneyed city, it's always been an empire state. It is now really the pinnacle of the empire state.
Yeah.
Like, you're not going to have fun unless we get a dime out of this bitch.
Right.
You know, I think that's what it's become so much more safer for the money people and the tourists. So if you're bringing something new and it's foreign and it's alien, you better get that shit out of here.
We'll be right back with the rest of our talk with Combat Jack. If you like what you're hearing on Outside the Lines, go to iTunes and give us a review. The more 5-star reviews we get, the more attention and the easier it is to keep getting high-quality guests like the ones we've been having. We continued our chat with Reggie Osei, a.k.a. Combat Jack, by talking about his earliest memories of music.
So even with regard to just accessibility, it also had to do with us as kids growing up in an age where we listened to all types of music. So even though music was a new, hip-hop was a new scene, and I quickly identified with hip-hop, my roots were still in disco, my roots were still in soul, my roots were still in rock and pop and all of this. So you had clubs where, like the Paradise Garage, where house music was kind of like this, also this new kind of culture that was kind of seamed in between punk rock and hip hop, and it was only natural that if you weren't at a punk rock club or at a hip hop club, you were at a house club, and you were hard pressed to tell the difference. Because being in the Paradise Garage, I'd see cats that I'd see drug dealers, I'd see the New Jack City, like the stereotypical New Jack City cats with the fat chains on, and cats that you knew were murderers in Brooklyn that had no time for nonsense, but they were into hip hop, and then they would be in the Paradise Garage, mixed with this, you know, very gay scene. You know, I mean, that's what New York was. It was, in a sense, before we had all of these terms, there was a lot more tolerance. There was a lot more tolerance. I mean, we were a lot more ignorant then. I mean, the world wasn't as PC as it is right now. And I think there was some freedom without, like, this kind of, like, PC police, because being tolerant was so much more natural than being forced to be tolerant right now.
Because you're in a room with people and in a club with them.
It was natural. It was natural. Like, and I'm not saying it was, like, this kumbaya, everybody get along community, but it was more natural for people of different walks of life to rub shoulders with each other and be in the same place and enjoy the same type of entertainment.
Along those same lines, you're obviously a lifelong Brooklyn resident,
yes,
minus a few years in,
yes,
you know, upstate and in D.C.
Yeah.
And now a landlord,
yeah,
in Brooklyn. And I was just hoping to get your thoughts about, you know, maybe some of the ways Brooklyn has changed, especially the area around the new stadium.
It's, to me personally, it's scary. It's a very scary phenomena. I am glad that Brooklyn is getting its just due, and Brooklyn is, you know, getting all of this attention and this influx of resources and the whole nine. But I'm scared because I remember coming up in Brooklyn and it being a very special place, and traveling to Manhattan was a process, and you had that option of going to Manhattan. But now that Manhattan is coming to Brooklyn, you know, I have concerns about the residents that just make it. And continue to just make it. And in that process of being able to just make it, they bring so much to the culture. The working class and the barely working class, they bring so much to the culture of Brooklyn. So, you know, seeing the neighborhood change just now, for example, I was a few minutes late. My wife homeschools students, and, you know, one of her students was stopped by the truancy police because they were, like, grilling her, and this girl doesn't look threatening at all. But I'm like, you know, it's become so much more policed because of the new residents that are coming in, and I feel it. You know, the original residents feel it, and so am I myself going to get priced out of Brooklyn? You know, it's moving so much so fast. When you hear that the Barclay Center is going to do so much for the community. I got to question that, because already I'm like, I'm seeing all of these shops that I went to all my life closing because they can't afford. Like, the rents right now for these commercial properties on Flatbush Avenue is crazy. Christie's beef patty shop. I think they've raised their rent to like $20,000 a month or something like that. He's like, I don't fucking sell crack. I sell fucking beef patties. How the fuck can I afford $20,000 a month on beef patties? So it's a shame that you can't go on Flatbush Avenue anymore and might not find a beef patty shop. Like, what the fuck is that? Like, I don't want to just see the chains. I don't want to just see the Starbucks and the, you know, I want the bodegas to still exist. That's a magical thing about New York. And if that doesn't exist in Brooklyn, then it's become Times Square all over again.
There was a few weeks ago on your show.
Yeah.
You had the therapy episode.
Yeah.
Right. And
great episode.
It was a great episode.
Yeah.
And towards the end of it, you said something that was just such an evocative phrase and so meaningful. And I was wondering if you could expound on it a little bit. You said, everything I see is enveloped in race.
Yes. It's become that. I was very naive growing up in Brooklyn. And it's actually kind of funny. Growing up in Crown Heights, Brooklyn, and going to a predominantly white school, St. Francis Xavier in Manhattan, like, my environment was just so cool. Like, everybody in my environment was so cool, from, like, the clothes they wore to, like, the rap scene and the dancing and just the women, just in terms of the shape. So when I went to Xavier, there was a period of time when I actually felt sorry for white people. Like, I was like, damn, like, you know, just the movements is not as fluid, and, you know, some of these kids have some weird hang-ups. I just didn't understand that. So my whole world was just Brooklyn, like, just urban Brooklyn. So I was like, I felt sorry for white people. I'm like, they're missing out on life. It wasn't until I graduated from law school and I couldn't get the jobs that my paradigm shifted. I was like, oh, shit, white people own the world. Like, it hit me, like, oh.
Once you're on the job market all of a sudden.
Yeah, but, like, over the years, you know, I went from, like, being this idealist that, you know, everything is equal and times have changed. But, incidents have happened. Like, you know, I've been arrested by the police for, you know, having a discussion with them and then just being thrown in the car and really realizing that had I had any, like, summonses or unanswered warrants, I'd be in the criminal system.
Yeah.
And I've seen where, you know, my white colleagues have had the privilege of not even being concerned about the prospect of criminality or whatever. And I'm not saying that things are perfect for white people. I'm just saying that, and I think that's where people get upset, particularly like with the rap geniuses and everything. There is a sense of privilege that is the elephant in the room. And now that I'm raising sons and seeing how at any given moment they may be criminalized and how they may fall victim to the system, and, you know, just, you know, people are talking about, you know, people are complaining about the unemployment rate being at, you know, 7.98%, where for black men it's fucking doubled, and no one discusses that. So seeing how, as a black man myself, we are in a sense this endangered species in New York City, let alone this.
Which is a metaphor used as far back as Cube's first record.
I see that every day.
Yeah.
I can't help but see race. I don't want to see race. And sometimes I might be being too, you know, just too sensitive, but I see it. Like, the other day when I came to the Rap Genius party, and it was such a great party, there was a group of guys outside, some white boys smoking some good white boy weed. You could smell the pungency from a block away. They were having a great time. And it was an innocent setting. But I was like, if that were a group of black men, that shit would be shut down immediately. Am I right or wrong? Like, for the most part. And so how can I not see race in a world that the karma of this country is so entrenched in race? I'm a Buddhist. So I am trained on a daily basis to be responsible for my actions, to really just look at my karma and try to straighten that shit out. That's what I do on a daily basis, on a spiritual basis. So we have not, as a nation, yet accepted responsibility for all the racial shit that has gone on. You know, the condos and the, you know, the complexes are built on the corpses of, you know, fucking racial, you know, fucking genocide. And that has not been addressed. And karmically, until that shit is addressed, it's still going to exist. We see the ghosts of karma every day, and it's still being perpetuated today. I don't want to get that deep in it, but how can you not be conscious, white, black, whatever, and not see race in New York City every day, in America every day?
That's one of the things. I was talking to a scholar about this, and she said, you know, she's a college professor, and she said, well, like, you know, kids will talk about the ghetto as if it's some place that just popped up out of nowhere, and right. All these people choose to live there and not talk about, you know, redlining and this and that and all the sort of structural features that created it.
I mean, I've had my mind blown, like, speaking even back as early as in my law school days and having conversations with my white colleagues who know nothing about what goes on in urban areas, and having this conversation about the discrepancies and the inadequacies, and them responding, well, if they don't like it, why don't they go back to Africa? And not even being an asshole, just like, that's their, from their perspective, from their limited perspective, that's the solution. And I'm like, motherfucker, you don't understand. So it's so amazing how in this world, I mean, in this society that is deemed to be the most powerful nation in the world, how so much ignorance, even for those that have and have the access to education, how they have no clue. Like, they're not being educated as to the true history of this country and why certain people are where they are and why some other people aren't where they are. It fucking drives me crazy. But amidst all of that, I still have to function. I still have to deliver. I can't be the so-called angry black man, because then I'm fucking a fuku and I'm discredited. You know, I still have to deliver content and have fun with my black and white counterparts. So it's kind of this weight that I carry every day. And then I bear it.
Moving on to a slightly lighter topic.
Sorry about that.
No, it's exactly.
But my thing is this, man. Yeah. I mean, getting back to that, like, one thing I love about the internet is it's afforded me the freedom to discuss race with an open community and not feel as if I'm being threatening or menacing. For me at least, I found a way to discuss race in a manner that's very inviting and address these issues and get like-minded people to say, okay, this is an issue. We may not have the solution, but at least we can recognize that it exists.
It's a really great conversation to start having. And, I think it's fantastic you do that. It's funny because it's funny to see, I think maybe slowly we can start to have conversations about this that we couldn't have several years ago. And I think one of the barometers for me has been, of all things, the success of Louis C.K. Because one of his best known routines is effectively a bit about white privilege. You know, it's been viewed tons and tons of times on YouTube, and people get it. He's sort of very challenging about these issues to an audience that's largely white and older, but wants to see themselves as progressive and hip.
You know, I mean, I think it's so important. I mean, one of the people that I love so much is Tim Wise.
Yeah, Tim Wise is great.
Tim Wise is so great. White man that talks about his white privilege.
Yeah.
And I think it's so important. I mean, if you're just hearing about this complaint from the oppressed, it doesn't mean shit. It doesn't mean shit, because I remember we had Dream Hampton on the show. We weren't necessarily talking about race as much as how at this point in her life, things happen in hip hop and she's totally unaware of it. So it doesn't occur to her. So if things are happening and it's not happening in your world, it's not occurring to you. But if you have white people that can speak freely about white privilege and present it in a manner that occurs to you, that is such an enriching conversation that brings
It's a shame that it takes that to.
But once again, I like just having a sense of compassion and understanding. I can understand it doesn't occur to most white people. Why should it? It's systematically designed so that it doesn't occur.
Of course.
So even that has to be. It shouldn't occur. So instead of someone being pissed off at the privilege that Rap Genius has, instead of like shouting out, you know, fuck you and, you know, culture vultures and whatever else you guys have gone through, it's like, no, let's talk about the privilege and let's have this kind of form and then let's start from there. Not saying that everybody has the same mission, but at least put it in a perspective that everybody understands. You know, I think white, it's this thing is not going to get solved without everyone's involvement. Like, Obama can't do it, Sharpton can't do it, you know, the black, you know, leaders can't do it. It's something that affects everyone. You know, I was on the train the other day, dressed with the hoodie on and running down the stairs because I was in a rush to catch a train. And this older white guy was walking up the stairs. And we kind of did that dance. And I looked in his eyes, and this guy was so terrified. He's so fucking afraid of me. Like, and I can only imagine in his eyes, I was a monster. I was this big fucking gorilla. And I was just like, you shouldn't have to. Like, I mean, I could be like, fuck you, whatever. But in my mind, I'm like, you shouldn't be afraid of me. Like, you shouldn't have all of this fear of me. So what the fuck? Like, this is an issue. Like, this can result in my death. This can result in my imprisonment or my. And it's. So this guy should not walk around in fear in New York City in a normal transaction. It affects everybody, man. Sorry again. No, I'm really passionate about.
I'm very glad to to talk about this.
Right.
Definitely. So, as like I said, kind of. Speaking of race issues, as a matter of fact, I was so glad to see that someone other than myself thought that Avatar was racist and terrible.
How can you not see Avatar being? I mean, and you know what? It's because it's all about.
I think I disliked it more even on a cinematic level
right.
than you did.
No, I mean, cinematically, I mean, I'm a sci-fi. Like, I'm still a geek. I'm a geek,
yeah.
And that's what's frustrating to me. I am a fucking geek. I love science fiction. I love fantasy. I love all of that shit, and I want to enjoy it like the next person. Like, I just want to like fucking suspend all. You know, disbelief and enjoy it.
And there's some noble savage nonsense in this movie.
And it's just like, fuck. Okay. Like on one end, and now I'm also being a responsible parent because I'm watching it with my kids. And I feel that, I think it's every parent's responsibility in the United States to teach their kids about race, black and white. And really teach about the history of race and the ramifications and how it affects them. So watching them, like, my thing is, you guys already have the white God and the white Jesus and Santa Claus. Do you have to fucking bring it into fucking Avatar? Like, I was watching Prometheus the other day, where the astronaut the so-called astronaut that created humanity, the scientist that created, had bluish white skin. It was just like the God complex is so prevalent that it's so damaging to the other people's sense of self, or can be. So, what was the original question?
Oh, just about Avatar.
Avatar was the most racist shit I've seen.
It's
Tarzan.
Yeah.
It's space Tarzan.
Yeah.
I'm going to come in, and I'm going to save this innocent little tribe from the evils of the white race because I'm the guy to do it.
Right. Yeah. So
it's King Kong. It's fuck.
Yeah.
It's,
and I was really glad to hear that that called out because, obviously it was something that
But this is my frustration. It's like, James Cameron is a brilliant guy. Does he not get it? Or does it not occur to him?
Right.
It has to occur to everybody, man.
Yeah. Moving back to your lawyer career for a second, there's, as someone who was sort of in middle school in the early 90s, I have to ask you, I've been wondering this, for a while now, what was Color Me Bad really like?
I mean, they were just a studio band that made a lot of money. And, I mean, the attorney that I was working for handled them more on a day-to-day basis, and we represented the production company that signed them. So they were like the face guys. They were like this band that they put together, and they made great music, and a lot of money was made behind Color Me. But how they were individually, I don't really know.
Okay. So it was more of a production team.
It was like another boy band.
Right.
They were just another boy band.
You're ruining my memories of middle school.
I'm sorry. That was a great record, man. That was a great record. And that record opened up a lot of deals for the production company.
I believe it. More generally, about the sort of 90s, you've talked about kind of mid to late 90s as this time when it was basically like raining cash in the industry.
Raining cash. I mean, I like the majority of the deals that I did. And I had a deal every day of the week, and any deal could yield anywhere from 5 to 10 to 15 to 100,000 like that. And you knew going in, man, that some of these acts that you were representing,
never going to put anything out.
There's no substance. You just probably have a great hook or a great look or this and that, and nothing's going to come out of this, but I'm not going to turn the deal away. So you had these deals coming in. The music industry was so rich. and just so bloated and just so full. And it's just so much money, you know, from like the cost of a regular CD to like the what they would spend on. I mean, you know, if you were a fan back then before digital downloading and you liked a single of a particular artist, you were going to buy that album.
Yeah.
Like, it was only natural that people...
In the long box.
Yeah, you flocked to the record stores to buy these overinflated CDs, and that fueled the industry.
Yeah.
And so there were no ramifications as to, like, bad deals or a sense of, like, ripping off the consumer, giving you, like, one half song and, like, all this other bullshit. It was money, man.
Do you view... I mean, knowing what you know now about the past, you know, 10 to 15 years, if you could go back, would you... do anything differently? Would you advise the top cats to do anything different?
I wouldn't advise the top cats. If I could do anything different, I would have gotten a shit out of Rockefeller. I would have said, listen, guys, I'm not going to charge you legal fees. Just give me a percentage. And when you get to a certain point, break me off. Like,
right.
That's what I would have done. I mean, you know, I didn't know what an MP3 was, man. And cats would come to my office and talk about all this digital shit, and I was like, I don't want to hear it. I'm making money off these fucking CDs. What can you tell me about the internet? Like, what can you tell me about? Like, until the iPod dropped, I mean, I try to imagine what the world, even with MP3s, what the world would be without the iPod. Because really, the iPod is what changed the game. It wasn't the MP3s, it was the iPod. You could not see...
You don't have to be in front of a desktop computer anymore.
Yeah, you could not see that shit coming. You couldn't see... So there was no way I could influence anybody to see that shit coming. I mean, you had fucking Napster approaching Universal about the possibilities of this new universe. So if they didn't get it, if fucking Napster couldn't convince these guys, you think I could? Like, there's nothing you could do, man. I would have just invested more in, like, the talents that I would have seen... that have blown up, and I would have gotten a percent. I wouldn't have charged them any legal fees. I would have gotten a percentage of it.
Nice. Winding down a little bit, one of the final things I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Rockefeller a second ago. You've said, you know, very openly that when you met him, you know, at sort of his tutelage under D. Dot, even then, Kanye was crazy.
Kanye was crazy. I mean, I'm sorry.
I guess, what has it been like to see, I'm quite in order to put this, the world grow into him? You know what I mean? Like, he stays the same, but his fame grew to fit his personality. You know what I mean? What has it been like to see that, seeing him, you know, before and now as kind of a megastar?
I mean, Kanye's been consistent. Yeah. Kanye has, I mean, people change, fame changes people, money changes people, but Kanye has been the same. Kanye's had the vision of who he would be. This is at the time the world didn't believe in him, but Kanye delivered. Like, it's not just the boast, it's not the affirmation. He delivered. He's a phenomenal artist. He's been a phenomenal artist, if not one of the most important artists of today, hip-hop and beyond that. He's one of the most... He delivered. But what I got from the Kanye's, just changing the question a little bit, what I walked away dealing with the Kanye's, dealing with the 50s and the Puffs and the Damon Dashes...
Yeah.
Is that you have to make it happen. Like, the world is not going to give you that deal. The world is not going to fucking open up its books. You have to make it happen. And it maybe took a little bit longer for me to incorporate that, but I have to see it. Like, I have to see the success of the Conrad Jack Show. I have to see the success of Reggie Ose and Dallas Benz and the Premium Pizza and everybody else that's on the team. I have to see that. I have to speak it. I have to live it. I have to be able to touch it before it's tangible. And that's really, if anything, if I could thank Kanye for it, it's that. Like, when I had Kanye in my office talking about how he was going to be the biggest rapper in the world in 2001. We had this conversation in 2001. This is before H to the Izzo drop. He's like, I've got this song called Izzo coming out, and that's going to open up the door for me to be this big artist. And in the back of my mind, I was like, right.
Who doesn't want to be the biggest rapper in the world?
Right.
Yeah.
But if anything I can thank him for is just believing in yourself. And we live in an age right now where regardless what's going on with the economy and industry, we have all the tools at our disposition to really make it happen. Like, it's never been easier to be a success, I think, than it is now. Because we have the tools. We don't have to go through you know, the gatekeepers, or we don't have to go through, you know, levels of, you know, lackeys and the whole nine. Believe in yourself. That's what I learned from Kanye. It's like, I don't care how wacky you are, how fucking bugged out you are, how improbable your dream is, you have to make it probable. And that's what I learned from Kanye.
Uh-huh. Excellent. So what's next for Reggie Ose, for the Combat Jack show brand?
You know, we've been approached to do something more on a visual level with a major muscle, and I'm very excited about that. Just trying to take it on all different formats, man. I mean, down the line, I'm going to say it. I'd love to host my own late night show. I mean, I think, you know, we had the since Arsenio, you really haven't had a contender. At least, you know, in pop late night, you haven't had a black contender. I do that on a weekly basis. And I want to throw my hat in. That's what I want to do. Like, I get such excitement interviewing people and talking to them. It's not even interviewing people, it's talking to people. It's getting to know them and trying to bring out. Everybody has a story. Everybody has a story. And I want to bring that story out. And there's a lot of stories that aren't being told, and I want to do that on as big a platform as I possibly can. So I'm just starting, and there's nothing that's going to stop us.
Excellent. Well,
and maybe, you know, it's interesting. I'd love to do a Rap Genius collab also, because I think you guys are great.
Yeah.
I do want to address that, man. I think, you know, like I said, I understand why you guys are getting the flack that you guys are getting, because it's very, you guys are easy. You guys are easy targets for whatever reason. Mabu is just this outlandish personality that kind of calls some of that animosity. And you guys have been very successful, and you guys, to the outside eye, you guys are all white. So it
which is, I mean, to be, you know, to defend us, it's not, you know, it is not the case, right, either with the staff or remotely with, okay, the users of the site.
But when you look at the New York Times, mm-hmm, article, and when you see the stuff that at least is being disseminated to the general public, it's like, okay, who are these guys from Yale that are coming in and capitalizing on everything, mm-hmm, that has been built on the backs of, like, the Cool Hercs and the whatevers? So you guys are, I understand the hate, but I don't get it, because I see the other side. You guys put the work in. You guys were smart enough to build this infrastructure. And you guys had the fortune enough to know who to speak to parlay the success that you guys have had. I think what you guys are doing is great. And the more I get to know you guys, it's like, yeah, you guys are getting a bad rap. And, you know, for all you other cats out there, instead of hating, man, like, if somebody's doing it, instead of hate them, man, get in that camp. Get in that camp and learn how they've done it. You know what I'm saying? Because if you guys are doing it, man, I want to do it too. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. We need, and, you know, the whole point is to create a sort of living history,
right,
of, you know, specifically hip-hop and, you know, moving into,
right,
other texts and whatever.
Right.
And the more voices and the more sort of credible, informed voices to help us with that, the better.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's definitely where, you know, someone like you can come in.
Definitely.
Or, you know, anyone who, you know, might critique us for sort of being New Jacks. It's,
right,
like, well, you know, you're not.
And there's nothing wrong with New Jacks. There's been New Jacks throughout mankind's history. Like, why hate the New Jack, man? You know, just if somebody's doing some shit new and different and is successful, get with that.
Thanks for listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. The show was created and written by Sean Sotero. This podcast was produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios. You can check him out at crosstownstudios.com. That's Cross with a K.
Like, it's not just the boast. It's not the affirmation. He delivered. He's a phenomenal artist. He's been a phenomenal artist, if not one of the most important artists of today.
Our show's intern is Sonny Kahara, music by Psionic. This interview was recorded by Marguerite of LA Stereo TV. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, when we talk to the amazing Freddie Fox, a.k.a. Bumpy Knuckles.